English institutions and accepted norms and practices are intolerant. In a culture of stable, long-established, institutionally supported, and widely accepted tolerance, status quo conservatism and authoritarianism will essentially be unhitched, and status quo conservatism will lend little support to intolerant attitudes and behaviors. Contrast status quo conservatism, then, with authoritarianism, an enduring predisposition to favor obedience, conformity, oneness, and sameness over freedom and difference. Bear in mind that we are speaking here of a psychological predisposition and not of political ideology, nor of the character of political regimes. Note also that we make no claims about the psychological predispositions of Donald Trump, Marine Le Pen, or any other political leader. Authoritarianism is an attribute of the follower, not necessarily of the leader. And one does not need to be an authoritarian to successfully deploy authoritarian rhetoric and attract authoritarian followers. Authoritarianism is substantially heritable. McCord and others, 1999. Ludicky, Johnson, and Bouchard, 2013. And mostly determined by lack of openness to experience, one of the big five personality dimensions, and by cognitive limitations, Stenner, 2005. These are two factors that reduce one's willingness and capacity, respectively, to tolerate complexity, diversity, and difference. In contrast to status quo conservatism, authoritarianism is primarily driven not by aversion to change, difference over time, but by aversion to complexity, difference across space. In a nutshell, authoritarians are simple-minded avoiders of complexity, more than closed-minded avoiders of change. Stenner, 2009b, 193. This distinction matters for the challenges currently confronting liberal democracy, because in the event of an authoritarian revolution, authoritarians may seek massive social change in pursuit of greater oneness and sameness, willingly overturning established institutions and practices that their psychologically conservative peers would be drawn to defend and preserve. To avoid tautology with the dependent variables we are trying to explain, a problem that plagued earlier research on the authoritarian personality, Adorno and others, 1950, Stenner, 2005, usually gauges latent authoritarianism with a low-level measure of fundamental predisposition. Typically, respondents' choices among child-rearing values. For example, when asked what qualities should be encouraged in children, authoritarians tend to prioritize obedience, good manners, and being well-behaved over things like independence, curiosity, and thinking for oneself. Pitting this bare-bones measure of authoritarianism against any variety of conservatism and the whole roster of socio-demographic variables, including education, income, gender, class, and religiosity, Stenner, 2005, 133, 2009a, 152, has shown via the World Values Survey that authoritarianism is the principal determinant of general intolerance of difference around the globe. What authoritarianism does. Authoritarianism inclines one toward attitudes and behaviors variously concerned with structuring society and social interactions in ways that enhance sameness and minimize diversity of people, beliefs, and behaviors. It tends to produce a characteristic array of functionally related stances, all of which have the effect of glorifying, encouraging, and rewarding uniformity, and disparaging, suppressing, and punishing difference. Since enhancing uniformity and minimizing diversity implicate others and require some control over their behavior, ultimately these stances involve actual coercion of others, as in driving a black family from the neighborhood, and more often, demands for the use of group authority, that is, coercion by the state. In the end, then, suppression of difference and achievement of uniformity necessitate autocratic social arrangements in which individual autonomy yields to group authority. In this way, authoritarianism is far more than a personal distaste for difference. It becomes a normative worldview about the social value of obedience and conformity versus freedom and difference, the prudent and just balance between group authority and individual autonomy, Duckett, 1989, and the appropriate uses of, or limits on, that authority. This worldview induces bias against different others, racial and ethnic outgroups, immigrants and refugees, radicals and dissidents, moral deviants, as well as political demands for authoritative constraints on their behavior. The latter will typically include legal discrimination against minorities and restrictions on immigration, limits on free speech and association, and the regulation of moral behavior, for example, via policies regarding abortion and homosexuality, and their punitive enforcement. When authoritarianism does this, Stenner's theory of the authoritarian dynamic tells us exactly when authoritarianism does these things, making it a useful tool for understanding the current wave of populism. As noted earlier, the authoritarian dynamic posits that intolerant behavior is a function of the interaction of an enduring psychological predisposition with transient environmental conditions of normative threat. Stenner contends that, in the absence of a common identity rooted in race or ethnicity, the usual case in our large, diverse, and complex modern societies, the thing that makes us and us, that makes us one and the same, are common authority, oneness, and shared values, sameness. Accordingly, for authoritarians, the conditions most threatening to oneness and sameness are questioned, or questionable authorities and values, that is, disrespect for leaders and institutions, authorities unworthy of respect, and lack of conformity with or consensus in group norms and beliefs. This is what Stenner has termed normative threat, or threats to the normative order. Stenner, 2005, demonstrated the prevalence and significance of this authoritarian dynamic with many different kinds of data, showing that the intolerance produced by authoritarianism is substantially magnified when respondents perceive that the public and political elites are ideologically distant, or that leaders on all sides have let them down. See Stenner, 2005, page 57, from the Durham Community Survey, 1997. Are experimentally exposed to seemingly real news coverage about leaders unworthy of our trust, or fractured public opinion, where no one agrees on anything anymore, are being interviewed at a time of high variance in public opinion, that is, during some particularly fractious week in U.S. history, as determined by the actual variance in survey responses to the General Social Survey, 1972 to 2000. See Stenner, 2005, 314. Are living in a place, that is, some nation of the world, marked by high variance in public opinion. See Stenner, 2005, 314. From the World Values Survey, 1990 to 1995. In every case, normative threat dramatically increased the influence of authoritarianism on general intolerance of difference, racial, political, and moral. The latter constitute the authoritarian's classic defensive arsenal, concerned with differentiating, defending, and glorifying us in conditions that appear to threaten us by excluding and discriminating against them, racial and ethnic minorities, immigrants and refugees, political dissidents, radicals, and moral deviance. Notice that the activation of the authoritarian dynamic by collective threat in one domain will typically boost the display of these classic attitudes and behaviors across all domains. Thus, should fears about Muslim immigration activate authoritarian predispositions, this will usually provoke authoritarians to a whole panoply of sympathetic vibrations which might include strident demands to limit rights and protections for domestic racial-ethnic minorities, to restrict free speech and assembly, and to deploy state authority to write moral strictures into public policy. For example, to roll back gay rights and crack down on criminals. Without a theoretical framework that pulls all these seemingly disparate behaviors together as functionally related elements of the authoritarian's classic defensive stance, contemporary analysts can be left puzzling over, for example, why support for the death penalty and for the public whipping of sex criminals should turn out to be the strongest predictors of a vote in favor of Brexit. Kaufman, 2016. The authoritarian dynamic offers such a framework, which here we will test using recent Europulse data on populist voting across the US, UK, and France. The Europulse data set and our analysis plan. Data. Europulse, December 2016. The Europulse survey is conducted each quarter by Dahlia Research, Germany. Dahlia uses a proprietary software platform to reach respondents through web-enabled devices as they interact with a wide range of websites and apps. Dahlia seeks out users fitting the required profile for the task and offers them access to premium content in exchange for survey completion. This should reach a more representative slice of the relevant population and interview them under more natural conditions than is possible. For example, issuing email invitations to that atypical portion of a population that has sufficient interest, time, and energy to register for research panels and complete surveys on any topic for modest material rewards. One of the world's largest omnibus surveys, Europulse is conducted across all 28 EU countries in 21 different languages. 4 times a year, the Europulse survey interviews a census representative sample of 10,000 Europeans to track public opinion on a variety of topics. In the unique instance of the Europulse survey conducted over December 2nd through the 11th, 2016, just a few weeks after U.S. voters elected President Trump on November 8th, Dahlia added a representative U.S. sample to the Europulse mix. Their stated purpose was to enable researchers to detect any commonalities in populist support across the U.S. and Europe, including voting for Brexit in the U.K. and for the National Front in France, publicly issuing a research challenge to that effect. Excluding non-whites from analyses. The Europulse plus U.S. dataset of December 2016 included 12,235 respondents, n equals 1,052 in the U.S. sample, and n equals 11,283 across the European Union. However, given the nature of our research questions, we excluded non-whites from the current investigation, leaving n equals 661 in the U.S., which also excluded Hispanics, and n equals 10,500 across the EU. As explained elsewhere, Stenner, 2005, this is not to say that authoritarianism is necessarily expressed in a fundamentally different manner depending on race, ethnicity, or majority-minority status than among whites across Europe and the U.S. It is just that the demarcation of in-groups and out-groups and delineation of the norms and authorities to which one owes allegiance might vary. We would not expect, for example, any authoritarianism among African American leaders of the Black Lives Matter movement to propel them toward a vote for Donald Trump, nor North African Muslim immigrants in France to be attracted by any predisposition to authoritarianism to the National Front. Excluding non-whites left us a sample of 11,161 respondents from 29 countries, with 3,202 of those of special interest in our present search for a common dynamic in populist voting across the U.S. N equals 661. U.K. N equals 1,256. And France, N equals 1,285. Dependent variable, populist voting. The dependent variable throughout our analyses, our principal outcome of interest, was the probability of voting for populist candidates and causes. For the U.S. sample, this was reflected by respondents' self-report in early December of having voted for Donald Trump in the presidential election just a few weeks prior. For the U.K., the dependent variable was respondents' self-report of having voted a few months earlier in the British referendum of June 23rd in favor of leaving the European Union. For our French sample, populist voting was indicated by self-reports of intended vote in the upcoming election, which would be the presidential election of April-May 2017. There is mostly good correspondence between these self-reports and the real incidence of both vote turnout and vote choice in these elections, although our starting sample does seem to overrepresent Americans who turned out to vote, and to underrepresent Britons voting to leave the European Union, probably due to some combination of selection and social desirability bias. Karp and Brockington, 2005. Survey respondents are disproportionately likely to vote, and people tend to overreport engaging in civic behaviors such as voting. Similarly, it may be that those groups that leaned toward exiting Europe were disinclined subsequently to broadcast that, as well as generally less disposed to answering surveys. In any case, only those who said they voted, or intended to vote, in the case of France, were retained in the following analyses, leaving final sample sizes of 451, 858, and 1,045 for the US, UK, and France, respectively. Our dependent variable was scored 1 for a vote in favor of Trump, Brexit, or Le Pen, and 0 otherwise. We analyzed each of these three vote choices separately, since they reflect very different decision contexts. But we synthesized our findings across the three countries, since our main goal was ultimately to identify commonalities in the forces driving populist voting across liberal democracies. Main explanatory variable, authoritarian predisposition. We followed our previous practice in forming a bare-bones measure of authoritarianism from respondents' choices among pairs of child-rearing values. As always, we sought a measure that reflected something more akin to a deep-seated, enduring political personality than a current policy attitude that could do so across widely varying cultures with different in-groups and out-groups, dissidents and deviants, and that did not make specific reference to objects, actors, or events that featured in current political contests and might be the very subjects of our inquiries. We formed our measure of authoritarian predisposition from responses to the following 4 EuroPulse items. Which is more important for a child to have? Independence and respect for elders, obedience and self-reliance, consideration for others and good behavior, curiosity and good manners. Responses considered authoritarian, each scoring 1, were respect for elders, obedience, good behavior, and good manners. Alternatively, preference for children being independent, self-reliant, considerate, and curious reflected the inverse of authoritarianism, each scoring 0. Any inability or refusal to choose between a pair of values, don't have an opinion, was considered a neutral response, scoring 0.5. After summing these 4 components, rescoring the resulting scale to be of 1 unit range, and centering its midpoint on 0, to ease interpretation of interaction coefficients, our final measure of authoritarian predisposition ranged across 9 points, from minus 0.5 to plus 0.5. According to this measure, about a third of white respondents across these 29 liberal democracies proved to be authoritarian to some degree, in the sense of passing the neutral midpoint of the scale and leaning toward authoritarianism in their value choices. Specifically, 33% were authoritarian, 37% were non-authoritarian, and 29% were balanced or neutral. Key interaction condition, normative threat. We constructed an overall measure of normative threat from several key sentiments found in the Europulse survey. We sought to reflect three core components of threat to the normative order: loss of societal consensus, loss of confidence in leaders, and loss of confidence in institutions. First, the closest sentiment we could find in the Europulse survey to perceived loss of consensus was the express feeling that one's country was going in the wrong direction, either very wrong or somewhat wrong, in response to the question, over the past 5 years, has the United States, has the United Kingdom, has France gone more in the right or wrong direction? Second, we measured general loss of confidence in leaders by means of strong agreement with the statement, government is controlled by the rich elite, which readers might recognize as an item sometimes deployed in measures of populism. Recall our earlier assertion that so-called populist sentiments might more simply be understood as perceptions of normative threat. Third, we wanted to measure loss of confidence in government institutions in a way that captured both dissatisfaction with the current government and disillusion with democratic government more generally. To this end, we combined ordinal scale responses to two questions. How satisfied are you with the way democracy works in your country? Which ranged across 4 points, from very satisfied up to not at all satisfied. And what is your opinion of the government in the United States, the United Kingdom, France? Which ranged across 5 points, from very positive to very negative. Summing these two equally weighted components created a finely graduated 19-point measure reflecting dissatisfaction with democratic government. Finally, our overall measure of normative threat standardized and summed these three equally weighted components and rescored the result to be of 1-unit range. This overall scale, deployed in all subsequent analyses, ranged across 75 points, from minus 0.5 to 0.5, centered on a midpoint of 0. Other explanatory variables. Economic evaluations. An adequate test of the explanatory power of the authoritarian dynamic in this domain must necessarily also control for the economic distress that is traditionally cited as fueling populist sentiments and voting behavior. A number of scholars have noted recently that economic factors actually seem rather weak and inconsistent predictors of populism and intolerance, particularly compared with value conflict and cultural backlash. See Engelhardt and Norris, 2017. Stenner, 2005, previously found that to the extent that economic factors did predict expressions of intolerance, the effect tended to be confined to negative retrospective evaluations of the national economy, which might be felt as a kind of collective threat by authoritarians, although the effects of such threats were rarely as powerful or consistent as the classic normative threats. In contrast, Stenner found that personal economic distress tended to either be inconsequential or actually diminish the impact of authoritarianism on intolerance, perhaps by distracting authoritarians from their problematic concern with the fate of the collective, thereby improving their behavior. Fortunately, the Europulse survey measured the standard array of economic evaluations, including 4 items asking for retrospective and prospective evaluations of both the national economy and one's own household finances, as follows. Retrospective evaluation, national economy. How do you think the general economic situation in the United States, United Kingdom, France, has changed over the past 12 months. It has got a lot better, got a little better, stayed the same, got a little worse, got a lot worse, don't know. Prospective evaluation, national economy. How do you expect the general economic situation in the United States, United Kingdom, France, to change over the next 12 months? It will get a lot better, get a little better, stay the same, get a little worse, get a lot worse, don't know. Retrospective evaluation, household finances. Compared to 12 months ago, your household financial situation is a lot better, a little better, the same, a little worse, a lot worse, don't know. Prospective evaluation, household finances. How do you expect the financial position of your household to change over the next 12 months? It will get a lot better, get a little better, stay the same, get a little worse, get a lot worse, don't know. As noted, these discrete evaluations, whose pairwise correlations here ranged from 0.20 to 0.54, have typically been found to exert varying influence on intolerant and populist sentiment, and were thus left as distinct predictors in our model. Models and methods. We employed logistic regression to analyze each of our dichotomous measures of populist voting as a function of the authoritarian dynamic. The interaction of authoritarian predisposition with our overall measure of normative threat. Note that each of these models also originally included as controls the four discrete items reflecting economic evaluations, as well as the interactions of those evaluations with authoritarianism. With sample size trimmed by the elimination of non-whites and non-voters, it was important not to overload the models, particularly in view of their estimation via logistic regression. Thus, if any of these evaluations or their interactions proved statistically insignificant, they were removed from the model in question. The full models and raw results, logit coefficients, from which the findings presented here in the text are derived, are reported at www.karenstenner.com under Repository. Before turning our focus to the authoritarian dynamic, we note first that authoritarianism did indeed prove to be the main background determinant of populist voting across all three countries in our investigation. That is to say, there was no socio-demographic variable whose impact on populist voting exceeded that of our basic child-rearing values measure of authoritarianism. Not education, income, religion, gender, age, or urban-rural residence. We found that the impact of authoritarianism was substantial even under ordinary conditions, among those not feeling particularly threatened or reassured, increasing the probability of a populist vote by about 0.42, 0.30, and 0.24 in the US, UK, and France, respectively. Put more simply, even given middling perceptions of normative threat and their polity, Americans ranged from about a 0.21 to a 0.63 probability of voting for Trump as authoritarianism went from its lowest to its highest levels. Similarly, highly authoritarian Britons had about a 68% likelihood, and their non-authoritarian peers about a 38% chance, of voting to leave the European Union when perceptions of normative threat were unremarkable. And under those same conditions, about 31% of highly authoritarian French voters would likely opt for Le Pen, compared to only about 7% of their non-authoritarian compatriots. Finally, our evaluation of the evidence is not complete until we consider how normative threat affects those at the lower bound of the authoritarian spectrum. Across two decades of empirical research, we cannot think of a significant exception to the finding that normative threat tends either to leave non-authoritarians utterly unmoved by the things that catalyze authoritarians, or to propel them toward being, what one might conceive as, their best selves. In previous investigations, This has seen non-authoritarians move toward positions of greater tolerance and respect for diversity, under the very conditions that seem to propel authoritarians toward increasing intolerance. In a nutshell, authoritarians act more like authoritarians, and non-authoritarians more like their antithesis under these conditions. As authoritarians move to shore up their defense of oneness and sameness, non-authoritarians may redouble their own efforts on behalf of the open society. Based now on this latest evidence, it seems that non-authoritarians' activation in defense of freedom and diversity over obedience and conformity includes rejection of populist candidates and causes that fail to share this vision of the good life. Certainly, this appears to hold at least for non-authoritarians in the contemporary United States. It is sobering indeed to ponder the self-fueling properties of this dynamic, where perceptions of normative threat produce increasing polarization that in turn further exacerbates normative threat, which is surely implicated in our debilitating contemporary culture wars. See also Hetherington and Weiler, 2009. Economic factors, weak and inconsistent. The one empirical task that remains is to compare the impact of the authoritarian dynamic on support for populist candidates and causes with that of economic distress, variously conceived. As noted at the outset, the notion that populist attitudes and behaviors are driven, in some way, by economic distress is one of the most common accounts offered for the current wave of populism in the wake of the GFC, the decline of manufacturing, and the inevitable dislocations of globalism. It is a highly rational account of the populist phenomenon, with economics and materialism at its core, and analysts offering these kinds of accounts sometimes go to considerable lengths even to reframe manifestly non-material explanations in materialistic terms. For example, there is the argument that anti-immigrant sentiment is not really, or only, about immigration, but instead, or additionally, a means of expressing economic fears and displacing them onto the immigrants, refugees, minorities, guest workers, terrorists in the making, who are purportedly stealing the natives' jobs and draining communal resources that ought to be reserved for the locals. Our own investigation finds the evidence in support of the notion that populism is mostly fueled by economic distress to be weak and inconsistent. However, that distress is conceptualized. Preliminary analyses confirm that the four economic evaluations available in the Europulse data, retrospective and prospective evaluations of the national economy and household finances, represented distinct sentiments and ought to be entered separately in our model. In terms of both the magnitude and direction of their effects, these four variables exerted widely varying influence on populism. This persisted even without controlling for authoritarianism and normative threat, and regardless of whether the model included interactions between authoritarianism and the various economic components. We found that the effects of these economic evaluations were either weak and inconsistent, or sometimes large and counterintuitive. Evaluations of household finances seemed mostly inconsequential as predictors of populist voting, which accords with the generally modest effects discerned for income. Perceptions of past national economic decline had some mixed effects, including, in the case of France, in interaction with authoritarianism, but certainly seemed to propel some voters toward Trump. Yet even that finding sits side by side with a seemingly counterintuitive result, with positive evaluations of the economic future apparently associated with support for both Trump and Brexit. Of course, the direction of causality remains unclear. Given that these hopeful sentiments were measured after the vote in each case, it is quite possible that having voted for Trump, Brexit, these voters consequently felt more optimistic about the future. It is plausible that a vote for Trump may have reflected in some part dissatisfaction with past economic progress, together with hope for a future economic turnaround. If so, this would make America's choice of a billionaire businessman for president an expression not just of unleavened economic fear and disappointment, but also at least a touch of economic hope and optimism for the future. In any case, what we found is that there is no real pattern to be discerned in regard to economic influences across either the different economic components or the different polities. This would accord with the inconsistent findings typically reported by others, and with the general state of uncertainty regarding whether we are truly confronting a wave of populism and whether it is surging or has stopped, and also with the continuing disagreement over the direction of causality between anti-immigrant sentiment and professions of economic distress. We refer here to the dispute over whether our populists are typically starting with, real or imagined, perceptions of financial economic threat and projecting that onto easy targets like immigrants, or whether they are starting with their opposition to immigration, and due to the constraints of political correctness, merely expressing that as economic distress. That is to say, the immigrants are stealing our jobs. We think the totality of evidence tends to favor the latter, a theme we will return to below. Discussion. Implications for liberal democracies. Democracy does not breed Democrats. Trump ascended to the American presidency. Britain exited Europe, and the French flirted with the National Front, because Western liberal democracies have now exceeded many people's capacity to tolerate them, to live with them, and in them. This is hard to accept until one comes to terms with two critical realities. First, people are not empty vessels waiting to be filled with appreciation and enthusiasm for democratic processes. It is perhaps ironic that tolerance of difference is now threatened by liberal Democrats' refusal to recognize that many of their fellow citizens are different. We all come into the world with distinct personalities, which is to say, predisposed to want, need, and fear different things, including different social arrangements. Presumably, societies with a diverse mix of complementary characters tended to survive and adapt to changing environments in human evolution. Notwithstanding some ancient migration bottlenecks, these different personalities, authoritarian and libertarian, open and closed, risk-seeking and risk-averse, to name but a few, have, over time, distributed themselves all around the world. This means there are plenty of would-be liberal Democrats languishing in autocracies, and many authoritarians struggling along under vibrant liberal democracies. Second, there is remarkably little evidence that living in a liberal democracy generally makes people more democratic and tolerant. This means that most societies, including those blessed with democracies, will persistently harbor a certain proportion of residents, by our calculations, roughly a third, who will always find diversity difficult to tolerate. That predisposition and those limitations may be largely immovable. And this is the most important implication. If we are right about normative threat serving as a critical catalyst for these characters, then the things that multiculturalists believe will help people appreciate and thrive in democracy, experiencing difference, talking about difference, displaying and applauding difference, are the very conditions that encourage authoritarians not to the heights of tolerance, but to their intolerant extremes. Democracy in general, and tolerance in particular, might actually be better served by an abundance of common and unifying rituals, institutions, and processes. Is anybody listening? Democratic enthusiasts and multiculturalists sometimes make the mistake of thinking we are at an enlightened point in human history. Fukuyama, 1992. When all these different personalities, daily experiencing the joys of increasing liberty and democracy, are evolving in a fairly predictable and linear fashion into more perfect democratic citizens. This is why the populist wave strikes many observers as a momentary madness that comes out of the blue, and why the sentiments that seem to fuel these movements are often considered merely the products of frustration, hatred, manipulation by irresponsible populist leaders. Certainly not serious, legitimate preferences that a democracy must attend to. When authoritarians raise concerns about, say, the rates or sources of immigration, they are not actually saying, "I'm scared I might lose my job." But in fact, "This is making me very uncomfortable, and I don't like where our country is headed. Moreover, nobody will let me say so, and only this Trump-like figure is listening to me." Our sense is that if Trump had not come along, a Trump-like figure would have materialized eventually. It may be the case that many Republicans would have voted for anyone marketed under the Republican brand. And Hillary Clinton may well have won if FBI Director James Comey had not made his ill-timed announcement. And it seems likely that Russian interference tilted the outcome. But one must still explain why a Trump-like figure was even within reach of the presidency, and why Trump-like figures are popping up all over, and why the outrageous statements that critics thought would surely destroy their candidacies seem to be the very things that most thrill their supporters and solidify their bases. Trump publicly inviting Russia to hack into Clinton's private emails was shocking to many from a number of perspectives. But perhaps the most prominent was the lack of horror expressed by many of his supporters at what might conceivably be characterized as treason. When being interviewed about his foreign policy, Trump assured us that he himself would happily take out the families of suspected ISIS terrorists, essentially making a public declaration of his willingness to commit war crimes. Far from provoking horror, Trump's many astonishing statements, all indelibly infused with classic authoritarian sentiments and stances, were greeted with a kind of exhilaration by his supporters. It became clear that a large portion of the American people felt the nation's political leaders had not just failed them, but actually did not represent them. Here, represent goes well beyond mere political representation to something more primitive, like belonging. In essence, you are not us. In this state of mind, it no longer seemed beyond the pale to publicly invite a dangerous and long-standing adversary to spy on the country's leaders, or extol the effectiveness of war crimes for nipping terrorism in the bud. The gleeful reactions of Trump supporters to his strongman posturing attested to their anger and bitterness regarding the political correctness of the liberal elite, and the pleasure they seemed to derive from watching someone who sounds like us finally sticking it to them. Immigration policy and democratic discourse. Clearly, immigration policy is the flashpoint for populism, and offers a critical starting point for any new efforts at civil peace. If citizens say they're concerned about the rate of immigration, we ought to at least consider the possibility that they're concerned about the rate of immigration, and not merely masking a hateful racism or displacing their economic woes onto easy scapegoats. Common sense and historical experience tells us that there is some rate of newcomers into any community that is too high to be sustainable, that can overwhelm or even damage the host and make things worse for both old and new members. It is also common sense that some newcomers are more difficult to integrate than others, especially when there are clashing values and lifestyles. Some might, accordingly, need to be more carefully selected, or more heavily supported and resourced to encourage and aid their assimilation. All these things must be considered when formulating a successful immigration policy. Height, 2016. Ignoring these issues is not helpful to either the hosts or the newcomers. It is implausible to maintain that the host community can successfully integrate any kind of newcomer at any rate whatsoever, and it is unreasonable to assert that any other suggestion is racist. As noted, we already have some idea of what the requirements for social cohesion are in many other contexts. There are surely types and degrees of affinity between host and newcomers, rates of entry, and methods of supporting their assimilation and inclusion that facilitate successful integration into the community. Frank consideration of these matters is the key to broad acceptance of immigration policy and vital to the continued health of our liberal democracies. For all the reasons we have canvassed, these things are not currently known, but are knowable. It is essential for free societies to discuss these issues openly, and a matter of great urgency that we empirically investigate these parameters and settle the matter with hard evidence. Most obviously, if we were able to discuss these kinds of questions openly, they could simply be incorporated into mainstream political debates and effectively managed by normal political processes, cutting much of the fuel for intolerant social movements. Another important benefit of better immigration policies is that the resulting improvements in social inclusion and cohesion are likely to reduce the prospects of radicalization and terrorism, since these phenomena may be driven, in large part, by the disintegration of perpetrators from their families and communities. Democracy's Core Dilemma and a Critical Crossroads. Although we have paid great attention here to the role played by normative threat in the populist phenomenon, one critical thing to note about authoritarians is that they are not especially inclined to perceive normative or indeed any other kind of threat. They are just especially reactive when they do. If anything, authoritarians, by their very nature, want to believe in authorities and institutions. They want to feel they are part of a cohesive community. Accordingly, they seem, if anything, to be modestly inclined toward giving authorities and institutions the benefit of the doubt, and lending them their support until the moment these seem incapable of maintaining normative order. As our observation of the mechanics of the authoritarian dynamic made clear, authoritarians are highly reactive and highly malleable. Depending on their assessment of shifting environmental conditions, they can be moved from indifference, even positions of modest tolerance, to aggressive demands to crack down on immigrants, minorities, deviants, and dissidents, employing the full force of state authority. This is to say, the current state we find ourselves in can easily be made much worse or much better by how we come together and respond to this now in terms of attending to people's needs for oneness and sameness, for identity, cohesion, and belonging, for pride and honor, and for institutions and leaders they can respect. This should take the place of demeaning and ridiculing authoritarians, ignoring their needs and preferences, which is an undemocratic way for a democracy to treat a third of its citizens, and simply waiting for them to come back to their senses. It is condescending to say that no sane, reasonable person could want the things they want. Therefore, they must be unhinged, or else are being manipulated. But this is no momentary madness. It is a perpetual feature of human societies, a latent pool of need that lurks just beneath the surface and seems to be activated most certainly by things that constitute the very essence of liberal democracy. Things such as the experience or perception of disobedience to group authorities or authorities unworthy of respect, nonconformity to group norms or norms proving questionable, lack of consensus in group values and beliefs, and in general, diversity and freedom run amok. Stenner, 2005, 17. Liberal democracy has now exceeded many people's capacity to tolerate it. An absent proper understanding of the origins and dynamics of this populist moment, well-meaning citizens, political parties, and governments are likely to respond to these movements in ways that serve only to exacerbate their negative features and entirely miss their possibilities The same warning goes out to all of Western Europe and the English-speaking world post-Brexit. Worst of all, we might miss the real opportunities for a thoughtful, other-regarding reconciliation of two critical parts of our human nature: the desire to liberate and enable the individual, and the impetus to protect and serve the collective. We have shown that the far-right populist wave that seemed to come out of nowhere did not, in fact, come out of nowhere. It is not a sudden madness, or virus, or tide, or even just a copycat phenomenon, the emboldening of bigots and despots by others' electoral successes. Rather, it is something that sits just beneath the surface of any human society, including in the advanced liberal democracies at the heart of the Western world, and can be activated by core elements of liberal democracy itself. Liberal democracy can become its own undoing because its core elements activate forces that undermine it, and its best features constrain it from vigorously protecting itself. So it seems we are not at the end of history. Fukuyama, 1992. The last man is not a perfected liberal democrat. Liberal democracy may not be the final form of human government. And intolerance is not a thing of the past. It is very much a thing of the present and of the future. States of Emergency. Bruce Ackerman. There is something about the presidency that loves war talk. Even at its most metaphorical, martial rhetoric allows the president to invoke his special mystique as commander-in-chief, calling the public to sacrifice greatly for the good of the nation. Perhaps the clarion call to pseudo-war is just the thing the president needs to ram an initiative through a reluctant Congress. Perhaps it provides rhetorical cover for transforming the courts into rubber stamps, or perhaps it serves as a grand occasion for ego gratification, or all of the above. We are not dealing with the constitutional novelty. Almost two centuries ago, Andrew Jackson was famously making war on the Bank of the United States, indulging in legally problematic uses of executive power to withdraw federal deposits from the enemy, headed by the evil one, Nicholas Biddle. To be sure, the war on terrorism isn't as much of a stretch, say, as the war on poverty or the war on drugs. Classical wars traditionally involve sovereign states attacking one another's territorial integrity, and it may seem a small matter to expand the paradigm to cover non-state actors engaging in similar assaults. Is there really such a big difference between December 7th and September 11th? The panic-driven responses of the Bush and Obama administrations only begin to suggest the dangers of equating the two events. The torture chambers at Guantanamo and elsewhere have largely been reserved for foreigners. Yet the presidential embrace of war talk could have also legitimated the sweeping detention, torture, and summary execution of countless Americans on the massive watch lists compiled by the security services. This danger is not merely hypothetical. There have been notorious cases involving citizens and legal residents. Nevertheless, their actual number has been relatively small. I hardly wish to minimize the terrible crimes against humanity committed by the American government over the past 15 years. Worse yet, its utter failure to make a serious effort to hold the responsible officials accountable only serves to compound our national disgrace. Nevertheless, we should recognize that this dark chapter in American history has not yet led to an all-out presidential assault on liberal democratic life in the United States itself. There may be worse yet to come. Recent terrorist incidents have not involved the deaths of thousands, as at the Pentagon and Twin Towers, or even hundreds, as in the Oklahoma City Federal Building. They have involved small numbers of deaths inflicted by a small number of attackers, whose weapons are primitive, but who often demonstrate their media savvy by choosing symbolically central locations for their assaults. These incidents have sufficed, however, to catalyze draconic revisions in anti-terrorist legislation in both Britain and France, as well as increasingly tough talk by Europe's sensible, centrist politicians. What to expect, then, of Donald Trump on the terrible day when Americans learn that 5 or 10 or 20,000 have been slaughtered in some new disaster? Make no mistake, we live in an age in which smaller and smaller numbers of terrorists can buy more and more destructive weapons at lower and lower prices. The state is losing its monopoly on mass destruction, and it will be impossible to preempt all future attacks. This is not, I should emphasize, a problem that has anything in particular to do with the threat posed by ISIS or its counterparts. There are 330 million people living in America, and it takes only a few hundred extremists with a few million dollars to obtain weapons that could devastate a major American city. The question is not whether our security services will preempt some of these attacks. They will. It is whether they will prevent all of them. They won't. We may be lucky. When the tragedy occurs, the sitting president may turn out to be a sober defender of our democratic traditions. But as the Federalist Papers remind us, enlightened statesmen will not always be at the helm. And we would be wise to seize the moment and consider how we might create a new statutory framework to control a full-scale presidential assault on our liberal democratic tradition. From this perspective, the transparent demagogy of President Trump may well represent the last realistic political opportunity to take this question seriously. Within a few short months, Trump's terrorist tweeting has already generated a bipartisan congressional initiative by Senators Jeff Flake and Tim Kaine to frame a new authorization for use of military force that would allow the House and Senate to reassert their constitutional authority over unilateral presidential war-making abroad. While this is important, it is no less important to frame an appropriate congressional response to the prospect of the abuse of presidential powers at home. It would be a mistake for Congress to rely on the Supreme Court to do the job for it. Suppose President Trump responds to a massive attack with a massive roundup of domestic terrorists. It would probably take a year or so before a legal challenge would reach the Supreme Court. Based on the justices' performance since September 11, it isn't at all clear how they would respond. While a majority has sometimes upheld basic principles of due process in dealing with terrorism, they have failed to fashion effective modes of relief for obvious victims of injustice. Worse yet, they have never formally overruled their infamous World War II decisions, Korematsu only one of several, upholding the long-term detention of Japanese Americans by the Commander-in-Chief. Unless they do so, it will be tough to forge effective constraints on the President's power to make war on his fellow citizens. Despite these caveats, it is too soon to dismiss the court as a paper tiger. Depending on the course of future appointments, the majority may well emerge as a significant force at its moment of truth. But I wouldn't count on it. Paradoxically, Trump's huffing and puffing, together with his demagogic behavior, may jolt serious Democrats and Republicans in Congress to take seriously the prospect of a draconian response to the next major attack, and seize the moment to consider a new statutory framework that would increase the chance of preserving our democracy before it is too late. The new initiative should explicitly reject the claim, made most explicitly by Jay Bybee and John Yoo for the Bush administration, that the Commander-in-Chief has the unilateral power to make never-ending war on the home front. It should instead create a new system of checks and balances based on a different and common-sense notion that a major terrorist attack will predictably create a state of emergency, warranting extraordinary measures over the short term, so long as decisive steps are taken to guarantee that they won't endure beyond the period of their obvious necessity. These basic principles are already a familiar part of the legal terrain. The newscasts constantly report declarations of emergency by governors responding to natural disasters. And though this is less familiar to ordinary citizens, presidents regularly declare emergencies in response to foreign threats. The challenge is to adapt these principles to deal with the distinctive features of the problem raised by the increasing ease with which relatively small terrorist networks can obtain weapons of mass destruction. First and foremost, the new framework should impose